Thank you for that very kind introduction. Thank you for this warm welcome. Before this began, Mr. Cody and I had lunch together and tried as best we could to divide up what each of us would say. I'm not sure I am really able to do that as well as I thought I would, but I'm going to do my best. And we wanted to talk separately about our relationship to Dr. King. And I've talked so much at the University of Virginia to my classes and to other audiences about one relationship I have with Dr. King. I hesitate to do it now. I'm going to do it anyway. I hesitate to do it now because it's an old story and just been repeated time and time again. And I was trying earlier today before my class in my office to figure out exactly what when the first time was that I met him, you know, shook hands, met him in a formal way. And I really could not put it together. But I know the longest time I had an acquaintanceship with him was when he taught me at Morehouse College. He went to Morehouse College, I went to Morehouse College. And so, you know, I'm one of eight people in the world who can say honestly that I was a student of Dr. King's. There are lots of people who say that, but most of them are just liars. Because he only taught one class, there are only eight people in the class, I'm one of the eight. And so I'm one of the eight people in the world who can honestly say I was a student of Martin Luther King's. This was a survey course in philosophy that he co-taught with a man named the Reverend Samuel Williams. Williams was an Atlanta minister, a professor of philosophy at Morehouse College, and president of the Atlanta NAACP. And I can remember this relatively small classroom with the two of them sitting at a table like this one here, facing us, and the eight of us sitting where you are, and that's how the class was conducted. Class met one day a week, every week, and it was supposed to have been a study of the great philosophers, Plato, Aristotle, and all the rest. Now, I've often wished that I had the wit to have bought a tape recorder to class, and I had tape recorded these pearls of wisdom that fell from the lips of this marvelous man. I didn't do that. I hope that I had the wit to take extensive notes, and I didn't even do that. In fact, I'm not embarrassed to say that I remember nothing that passed between teacher and student in the class. I hope my own students are not saying the same thing in a different way. Anyway, but I do remember one day, class was over, and he and I were walking across the beautiful Morehouse College campus. If you've never been there, if next time you're in Atlanta, you ought to take the opportunity, the beautiful Morehouse College campus. And I said to him, Doc, his friends called him Doc. I said, Doc, how are you feeling? And he said, Julian, I'm not feeling well. He said, unemployment is high, discrimination is everywhere, racism seems immovable. He said, I feel awful. I have a nightmare. I said, no, Doc, why don't you turn that around? Try I have a dream. And I sense some doubt here. And I should tell you, I just made that story up. But don't repeat it to others, because I was someplace making a speech and the fellow who introduced me read my biography and then said, and now the man who taught Martin Luther King to say, I have a dream, Julia. So please don't repeat it. But the relationship I have with Dr. King, we were never close friends. I can't pretend I'd like to, that we were close and intimate friends and we shared confidences and so on. I knew him in sort of a formal way. I saw him a great deal. I lived in Atlanta. He lived in Atlanta. I would see him in the bank, in the grocery store, in the drugstore, and so on. I saw him relatively often during the heyday of the Civil Rights Movement and at formal meetings of groups or organizations that we both belonged to, and at occasions we were both at the same place at the same time, in Selma, at the Selma to Montgomery March, at the March on Washington, and so on. But I can't pretend to have been an intimate friend of his, and I won't pretend to be that now. But the relationship I had with him changed over time. In 1955 and 56, when the Montgomery bus boycott burst upon the scene, like most people, I think, or most black Southerners anyway, or most Americans, I hope, became an instant fan of this articulate, poised man who seemed to have the right thing to say at the right moment, to summarize exactly what was going on there in ways that were understandable to everyone, to make the good a cogent argument for why the buses ought to be integrated, who could say how foolish they were in ways that were understandable to everyone, who just seemed to be the perfect spokesman for the program that he had undertaken in Montgomery, and I was so proud to know that he and I had gone, were going to the same college. This was before I went to college. I went to Morehouse College, at least in small part, because he had gone there and wanted to go to the same place he had gone and thought maybe some of that would rub off on me. But I didn't meet him until after I started college, and he was a regular presence on the college campus. We had compulsory chapel at Morehouse College. They've done away with it now, thank heaven. But we had compulsory chapel at Morehouse College, and you know, it's hard to find a different speaker every day, 5 days a week, and so, but King often filled that spot. It was just great to sit there and listen to him, listen to this marvelous orator telling, you know, these, if you never heard him speak in person, you're just missing a great deal. You can hear the recordings, and there are many. And you can read the speeches, and there are many. But to hear him and to hear that deep voice tell these stories in such a way, just a wonderful, wonderful occasion. So I enjoyed that experience and had it over and over and over and over again. And then the Civil Rights Movement began for me when the Greensboro sit-ins began on February 1st, 1960. And about February 3rd or 4th, I was in Morehouse College. I was a junior by that time. It was February of my junior year, and I was looking forward to my senior year, and then I had no plan at all for what would happen after that, but looking forward to it anyway. And I was sitting in a cafe near my college campus when a student approached me, an older student whom I knew only as a football player at Morehouse College, which is saying something because we had no kind of football team. But I knew this guy as a football player, and he came to me with a newspaper and held it up like this and said, "Have you seen this?" And I thought he was asking the question, "Do you read a newspaper?" And I was a little insulted because I thought all college students read a newspaper every day. But clearly he meant, have you read this story? And he pointed at it, and the story said, Greensboro students sit in for third day. And I remember having read the story. It told how students at North Carolina A&T University for the third day in a row had gone to the local F&W Woolworths department store, had sat down at the lunch counter, had been refused service, and who sat there for an hour, got up, another group of students took their place, they sat there for an hour, and so on, until the day when the store closed, and then they went away with a promise to come back the next day. It described how they acted, how they looked, how they were dressed, how they comported themselves. It was like a primer, how to sit in. And he said, "Have you seen this?" I said, "Yes, I have." He said, "What do you think about it?" I said, "I think it's great." He said, "Don't you think it ought to happen here in Atlanta?" I said, "It will happen here in Atlanta. Somebody will do it here in Atlanta." He said, "Why don't we do it?" And before I could say, "What do you mean, we?" He said, "You take this side of the cafe, I'll take the other, and we'll call a meeting." And we did just do that. We called a meeting, making sure to make sure we had somebody from Morehouse, Clark, Spelman, Marsh Brown, and Atlanta University and the Interdenominational Theological Center all together, because we didn't want this to be something only Morehouse students did. We wanted all the students from the Atlanta University Center, which at that time was the largest collection of black students anywhere in the country. It's not that now, but it was then. So we wanted to make sure every school was represented, the women's school, the men's school, the co-ed schools, the graduate schools, and the theological school had representation from every campus. And we got that together, and then we had our first sit-ins. And, you know, my colleagues in other places around the South, I learned later, in Nashville particularly, had extensive training in nonviolent resistance. They had mock sit-ins where they beat each other with rolled-up newspapers, pushed each other off the seat, shouted awful things at each other, tested whether or not they'd be able to stand up to the rigors of some kind of attack and still maintain that nonviolent discipline. In Atlanta, we just said, if somebody hits you, don't hit back, okay? Okay. And if you can't do that, don't come, okay? That was the extent of the nonviolent training I had. And on this first sit-in, I was chosen to lead a group to the Atlanta City Hall. I don't know how many of you have ever been to Atlanta or the City Hall or seen it, but the City Hall now has a new facade on the rear, a glass front, but then it had only a facade on the other side, which then the front side. Had stairs going upstairs, you went upstairs into a lobby, and then downstairs again there was a cafe on the basement floor. And I led my group of about 15 people, students from Spelman, Morris Brown, Morehouse, Clark, I don't think we had anybody from the graduate school, into this cafeteria, and the first thing I noticed was these black women working behind the steam tables looking at us with a mixture of fear and admiration. Fear because they knew what was happening. They'd read the newspapers about sit-ins north in the northern states above us, North Carolina, even South Carolina, and Virginia, And now these citizens were coming to Atlanta, and they were going to be a part of it. They were witness to it. But also a little fear, because they knew that police would soon come. And there was a natural tendency of black people in Atlanta, I think in all the South, to stay as far away from policemen as they possibly could, if they could. And so the combination of admiration for what we're doing and fear for what it might bring to them, you could see on the faces of these women. But we went down the steam tables, and we got our food and came to the end of the line. I was first in line. There's a white woman sitting at the cashier's table, cashier's stand. And like all Southerners, she was very polite. She said, I'm sorry, but we can't serve you here. And I said, why not? She said, this is for City Hall employees only. I said, you have a big sign out front that says City Hall Cafeteria, the public is welcome. She said, we don't mean it. I said, well, I'm going to stand here till you do. And she called the police. The police came and took us away and arrested us. This is the first time I'd ever been arrested. And I had a natural fear of having ever been arrested and a fear of being arrested this time. Luckily for us, Atlanta had a reputation that was part fact and part myth. But the factual part was it was a relatively benign set of race relations in Atlanta, and so the police were not the kind of people who would hurt us or harm us in any way. Locked us up and put us in this big pen, holding pen, in the Atlanta City Jail with all of these other people. And I sort of wondered to myself, why are they here? And then I thought to myself, probably better not to ask them. And so I didn't. But they knew why we were here. And they were happy to see us, and through some, either the radio or some other means, knew why we were there and what had brought us there, and were happy to see us and were congratulatory to us. I remember when time for food, for lunch came, they had three guys came by whom I later found to be trustees there in prison uniforms, one with a big garbage can, another with a rolling table with 10 plates and silverware on it, and the third one, with his arm up to here, it seemed to me, and beans, reached down in the garbage can and scooped up some beans and put them on the plate and handed us to us. That was my introduction to prison food, one I didn't want to see repeated ever again. In fact, I never had it repeated ever again. I made sure of that. And then after a little bit, thank you. After a little bit, we were called down. I was called down to a courtroom in the jail. There's so many people arrested, the authorities had decided to try one person for each group, and I was being tried for mine. I found myself standing between two men. On this side, Attorney Donald Hollowell, who was a younger man, and on this side, Attorney Austin Walden, who was the Dean of Black Lawyers in Georgia. The judge asked me, how do you plead? And I really didn't know how I pled. I didn't know if I should say I was guilty, because I didn't feel guilty, even though I had disobeyed the policeman's orders, or whether I should say I'm not guilty. Well, I turned to Attorney Walden, and he was like this. He was as old as I am now. And I turned to Attorney Hollowell, and he said, not guilty, you fool. And I quickly learned not to say that, or I wouldn't be standing here now. And I was bound over to a grand jury, and released on, or a bond was set for me, and in a few hours all of us were released. And the thing I remember most about it, and I'm far away from Martin Luther King really, is that I wanted my heroism to be reflected in a better, wider way than it had been up to then. And so I went to Spelman College for Women so we could say, yes, I was arrested. Look at me. But King, in the period of time I knew him, and I hope I can do this very quickly, period of time I knew him, he went through our relationship, although I'm saying we are not close friends, our relationship changed. I went through a period in which I was antagonistic to him and the way in which he operated, and suspicious of him, and wanted to not to have anything to do with him, a time when I admired and held him in great respect and affection. And so it was sort of an up and down relationship over a period of years. We used to say, take on that old vaudeville routine, here come the Lord, here come the Lord, here come the Lord. You remember that? Probably you don't. So it went up and down. But when he was killed, I remember I was at home in Atlanta. It was just such a blow. I felt as if a family member had been killed, as somebody extremely precious to me had been taken away from me. And I wanted it not to be true, but of course it was true. It was an awful, awful day, and I'll never forget it. And I'm looking forward to hearing from Mr. Cody. Thank you.
nearly ran out of time, and reminded when I got ready to come up here, I have an older daughter and a younger daughter, and the younger daughter is just 18, and she goes with me occasionally when we're I talk or do something, and she said, "Where are you going to go?" I said, "I'm going to go University of Virginia and talk to some students about Dr. King." And she said, "Well, just remember this, Pop. When you start telling stories about the old days, you talk too long." So I'm going to try to sort of give you the highlights of why I'm here, or why I was invited maybe to be here, and then maybe in the panel discussion, Julian and I can do a little bit more. I grew up in Memphis, a lockdown segregation community that was as good or bad or as anywhere in the South, and really, as people will know, didn't recognize that there was any real right and wrong about it, because black and white people had no relationships or experience. And I was well out of, with two exceptions, I was well out of law school here at the University of Virginia in 1961 before I'd ever been in a classroom with an African-American student of my age. I'd had a couple occasions in Europe and at a National Student Congress to be around kids, black and white, from other universities and parts of the country, but never where I lived. And as the dean said, when I graduated here in 61, I thought I was going to go to Philadelphia and practice real law and make money. That's what most of us want to do when we get out of law school. And this particular guy in Memphis, Lucius Birch, who was a fearless kind of guy, very quickly convinced me that I didn't want to go to a city that I had no roots in, no involvement in, just to have a job, but that at that particular time in the early 60s in the South, there were opportunities for lawyers to get involved in doing things in the civil rights movement that would not only allow you to be a lawyer, but also to serve some other purpose. And that's what he had been doing. And as I came to work with him, he had been, for the last several years, doing basic things such as working with others there to help allow the libraries and the parks to be integrated, interstate commerce, public accommodations, and even things like the zoo in Memphis. When I was growing up, there was a sign on Thursday that said, at the zoo, when you got ready to walk in the gate, no whites allowed, which meant the rest of the time, no blacks were allowed. And that's sort of the way the separate but equal was in places, not only Memphis, but around the South. So I came back and went to work for him in a small law firm that I'm still in now. We're about 50 of us now. There were 8 of us then. And getting involved in the things that he encouraged me to do, I began to work in voter registration in Mississippi, get involved with the American Civil Liberties Union, NAACP, and other organizations that were working in these causes. And my involvement with Dr. King only involved 2 days, even though, as Mr. Bond has said, I met him on other occasions and meetings, but I had no relationship with him until April the 3rd and the 4th. And since I had been the chairman of the American Civil Liberties Union in Memphis, and then had later been on the national board of the Civil Liberties Union in New York, that is how I became involved. It's not as if our firm or me or anyone else was sort of selected from a large group of lawyers to represent Dr. King in Memphis on those days. It was simply because when Dr. King had come to Memphis in the month of March, and there had been a march in support of the garbage workers. There was a big strike in Memphis. It started out as a labor dispute because the sanitation or garbage workers had walked off the job because the working conditions were so bad and so poor. They were making less or, for some of them, a little over a dollar an hour. They could work a full week and still qualify for welfare because it was so slow, so poor. And two incidents occurred in those times leading up to the strike. One was a policy that if it rained, the you didn't pick up the garbage. And the garbage workers, the men with the tubs, they were let off for the day and they didn't get paid. The white workers who drove the trucks, they got off and they got paid. So, and you have to remember back in those days, it wasn't a question of you push your buggy to the curb and the garbage truck comes by and they mechanize, pick it up, put it in there and do it. These workers actually had to go to the backyards or alleys and take your garbage out, put it in the galvanized tin tubs, put it on their shoulders and carry it out to the street where the truck was. And they didn't have uniforms at the end of the day with all the garbage that had been spilled on them. It was a very demeaning and awful. They were the lowest economic spots on the ladder. And the other thing that triggered this demonstration or strike was on one of the days when it was not too rainy to pick up garbage, but it was drizzling and it was lunch, a couple of the workers, the garbage workers, got their sack lunch and sat on the back of the garbage truck. And when they were doing that, eating their lunch, someone in the truck hit the lever, the gear lever there, and the compactor came down and crushed both of those men to death. And quickly their families and the community learned that there was no benefits, there was no insurance, there was nothing for these families. And so it escalated into a very tough labor dispute. But as it went on and the momentum grew, ministers, black ministers in Memphis and others began to join in, and what had been a labor dispute became a social movement and a civil rights movement, much bigger than the garbage workers. And so when Dr. King had come here and had a march in the month of March, it got broken up because his organization hadn't planned it. They started out, there were some kids that were not sympathetic to Dr. King at that time, as there was a black power movement in the country. A lot of the young people thought Dr. King was a history, that civil disobedience, nonviolence, turn the other cheek wouldn't work anymore. And because Dr. King would not let anyone participate in the march unless they committed to nonviolence, they were in the march but not made part of it, and they took the placards, the paper placards that were on sticks, tore them off, and began to break out windows. The police overreacted, maced the crowd. Many people were damaged. Stores were looted. Several people were killed by being shot. And Dr. King left the march, was taken away, and when he got back to the hotel, he announced on television that he was coming back to Memphis and he was going to lead another march that would be peaceful and nonviolent, and his people, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, would organize it and it would work and he would get results for the garbage workers in Memphis. And it, when he did that, the city attorney, of course, quickly went to federal court and said to the judge, look, he's coming back to have a march. We just had a march. People got killed. That's a dangerous situation, not only to Dr. King, but to everyone else. In federal court, gave a temporary injunction against Dr. King coming back to march. And so when that happened, Dr. King announced again I'm coming to Memphis. We're going to have a march. I don't care whether there's an injunction or not, because I've marched against injunctions in Selma and other places, and it's not, no injunction is going to turn us around. Well, the people in New York and other places were very concerned about that, the legal people, because throughout the movement, the federal courts had been the sort of support mechanism through busing or public accommodations or whatever to allow the civil rights movement to progress as much as it had. And the ACLU and others were concerned that if Dr. King marched in the face of a federal injunction, not some chancellor down Montgomery or Selma, Alabama, then that would dilute the support and protection that the federal courts gave to the movement. And that's a long way of saying how I came in. I had only been out of the University of Virginia 6 or 7 years, but I had been involved with the ACLU, and so at the time, the ACLU, Chuck Morgan and Mel Wolf, Chuck Morgan was a law partner of Mr. Bond's wife, not at that time, but later, they called me and said, will you represent Dr. King to get this injunction lifted? And being the naive young person I was, I said, sure, and then had not hung up the phone before I realized it was somewhere above my pay grade and that I was not up to this task. But this guy who had me come to Memphis and not go to Philadelphia and make all this money, he was the best lawyer in the city, and he'll represent Dr. King, and I will carry the books and do whatever young lawyers do. And so I went over, and Lucius Burt said, well, I need two things before I say yes. I mean, that stopped me, because I didn't think there was any question about it. And I really got kind of scared then, because I was pretty well committed. He said, two things. I want to have Dr. King personally engage us, so it doesn't look like we're volunteering to do this, even though it's pro bono. And so, I'll do 3 minutes. So we had this telegram which asked us to represent Dr. King, and the group of us going into court the next morning, I'll get there. This is Jim Lawson, a local minister, Andy Young, who was Dr. King's key aide and later mayor of Atlanta, United States ambassador to the UN. These are two witnesses, and then Lucius Birch, the real lawyer, is here in the middle with a hat on, and another young lawyer. But I want you to notice the guy on the left that looks like he's doing all the work with the books and everything, that's me. So we went down. Birch said he wanted to meet with Dr. King and have Dr. King articulate why this was so important. So we went to the Lorraine Motel the afternoon of August 3. King is killed the afternoon or evening of April 3 and 4. And so we're at the Lorraine Motel, knee to knee, lawyers on one twin bed, Dr. King, Andy Young, Jesse Jackson, Ralph Abernathy, Jim Lawson on the other, talking about why this is so important and what we're going to do in court the next day. And I know, Jim, I'll finish up, but let me just say, when we finished that discussion, some lawyers went back to start preparing the answers and papers for the next morning, federal court. I went with Andy Young and Jim Lawson to get them prepared for their questions. They were going to be our witnesses, and consequently went with them to Mason Temple, where Dr. King gave the mountaintop speech, which was the last speech of his life, and was one of the most dramatic, eerie evenings of my life, certainly. And then the next day we were in court all day. The judge told us to prepare the papers. He would lift the injunction, allow Dr. King to march. I took Andy Young after the hearing back to the Lorraine Motel, and before I could drive from the motel to to my house, 4 or 5 miles away, radio came on and said Dr. King had been killed on the balcony. And so that's sort of those 2 days, and maybe we talk a little more.
Thank you very much. And I believe that photograph you showed, we have copies that can be circulated, if I understand that correctly. Well, terrific. I have some questions to throw out, and either one can respond or both, and then we can move on to the next one. So this event is called The Final Days, and part of it is literally the final days, as Mr. Cody just spoke to. But part of what we want to understand is what were his final years about, because the conventional popular remembrances of King really focus on his role in the civil rights movement from the mid-50s to the mid-60s, which largely focused on overthrowing Jim Crow, legal barriers that were race-based, segregation and discrimination. But my understanding is in 67 and 68, after the Voting Rights Acts and Civil Rights Acts, he tended to focus more on economic inequality, including beyond just for African Americans, challenging the war in Vietnam, emphasizing human rights abroad and domestically, and that was in some sense a departure from what the earlier civil rights movement was about, although that part is often not even discussed in what the media tends to cover. So I wonder if I could ask you to comment on what you understand his concerns to be, what he was advocating in his final years after 65, and in what way did that depart from or in fact connect to the earlier civil rights agenda?
Well, I really have conflicted views about this, because I believe that he was always concerned about economic problems. I don't know, most people don't recall that when the Montgomery bus boycott began, the demand was not just for integrated seats on the bus, but for jobs as bus drivers. So here's an economic demand from the very start, 1955, when the bus boycott began. They dropped that demand, I think, for reasons that are not clear to me. That was the initial demand of the people running the boycott. They wanted jobs, because they knew how important jobs were to black people and how scarce they were. And then if you go forward to 1963, the March on Washington is the March for Jobs and Freedom. So it had an economic component too. Its main architect, of course, was A. Philip Randolph, who was a socialist, and for him, economic issues were primary. But the person who put the mechanical work to put together was Bayard Rustin, who had not only been a communist, but was a good leftist, and also had economic views at the top of the thing. So there's always this undercurrent of economic issues before King and in things King were doing. But I think it's the Memphis strike puts these issues so starkly. This is about nothing else but labor, organized labor. Whether or not these men can belong to a union, whether or not they can get a decent wage. It's so stark there, and much more stark than in any other of the campaigns he had been in. So it's where these issues come to the forefront, and he articulates them so well and so well. And remember this great speech, he says, all labor has dignity. It doesn't matter what you do, you have dignity if you work. So I'm of the school that believes he always was concerned with these issues, but at this particular time, they come to the forefront and he's able to articulate them more. And so as a consequence, we say he only began to think about them in Memphis, but indeed, I think he was thinking about them all along.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly in terms of what he was about in Memphis on April 3 and 4, when he met his death there, was economic, as has been said. And in the afternoon that we spent with Dr. King and Lucius Birch, kind of getting him to justify the need for the march and why it was so important, and again, in the testimony at the trial or hearing the next day, it was clear that one of the reasons he had come to Memphis was because he and others in Memphis felt like that as he planned what they called the Poor People's March in Washington, D.C., which was going to happen later, where he was going to bring poor people from all over the country to the mall in Washington and camp out there until Congress or the administration did something to address economic rights, the whole idea was that unless King could come to a place like Memphis, where you had the sort of lowest of the low economically, garbage workers, and get a victory for them through nonviolent demonstration, then he couldn't go to Washington with confidence that that would work, and that this he felt like he had to be able to show he could do it in this smaller arena in Memphis if he was going to attract the attention or the funding or the interest in the Poor People's March in Washington. So as Mr. Bond said, it was a very much an economic issue. Of course, as we have today in Memphis and other places, you know, it just happens that the poorest people are the black people in a place like Memphis. And so in the eyes of white Memphis, it was a black-white issue, but for the garbage workers, it was an economic issue. And as has been said, that was the issue I think Dr. King was there to address.
Of course, you know, it's such an issue right here where we are. I just signed a petition today being circulated among the history faculty to ask for a decent wage for UVA employees. Not for those of us who work in the now building where I am now. I make a good living working for the University of Virginia, but the people who sweep the floors, who clean the toilets, who pick up the trash, who take out the garbage, those people are miserably paid. And there's a segment of people at the university who, for as long as I've been here, have been fighting to correct that unsuccessfully. Perhaps they'll do it sometime soon. At least I hope they will. So these issues are ever present. They're with us right now.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Another question I have has to do with King's view of the federal government. So earlier in the Civil Rights Movement, he wrote about going into federal court and feeling a kind of lighter air, in some sense, a kind of freedom available in federal courts as distinct from state and local courts. And of course, the Civil Rights Acts and the Voting Rights Acts were demands made and secured from the federal government. Yet, Mr. Cody, in your experience with King, the injunction was from Judge Brown, a federal judge, that would enjoin the march, the second march in Memphis. And King said that he was willing to violate it, even though this time it was from a federal court, not a state court. So I wonder if, again, either or both of you can comment on how King viewed federal courts and the federal government, and whether those views changed by his later years.
I'd have to leave the long term to Professor Bond, but you know, I think the natural thing for King to say was an injunction is not going to turn us around. I mean, that's a rallying point. And I don't know if he would have worried as much about this issue as did the legal side about violating the federal injunction. I think he was ready to do it. I think he fully understood, though, that it was the federal courts that had been protecting the movement for so many years. The case that we handled for Dr. King was not difficult because we had a liberal federal judge that had been appointed by John Kennedy to the bench. He had been my law partner until the day he left to go on the bench, and I came and took over his office. And he was a University of Michigan graduate and a well-educated person, and he understood the law. But when the city came to him and asked for a temporary injunction without any defense from the other side, clearly he should have granted the temporary injunction and set a hearing to see what Dr. King and the others said. And basically the reason that the lawsuit was won and the injunction was lifted is because the judge was easily convinced that if the march was going to take place, Memphis would be a lot safer if Dr. King was leading that march with the skill of his team and people than if he is sitting in a Memphis jail for trying to start the march and getting arrested, and then the whole community is upset and in a roar. So there were a lot of dynamics to that, but all of us felt pretty solid that the federal judge eventually, within the restrictions we were going to propose, would allow the march to take place. And by the end of the hearing, and I just gave this transcript to the law school people, you will see that even the judge and the city is agreeing, okay, if we're going to have this march, let's have it so that there are only 5 abreast. We've got police on the outside. You've got marshals with armbands, as you'll see on my arm in the picture. You'll have no sticks on the placards. And so as we got to the end of it, there was going to be a march protected by the federal court and the marshals, and I think King probably knew that from the get-go.
I think as a general rule, King faced sympathetic federal courts and hostile state courts. And I say as a general rule because that wasn't always the case. And I'm thinking about these judges he faced in Florida, in Georgia, I'm sorry, Newell Edenfield, who was just an awful, awful person. I can't remember all their names, but I remember some of you are baseball fans, remember Tinker to Evers to Chance? No, I guess you don't.
Yeah. the ones
older,
a older
baseball. Anyway, that was a great triple play team, Tinker to Evers to Chance. And the Atlanta Constitution had a cartoon about federal judges upholding a decision involving race. I don't remember what the decision was. And the 3 judges who did it were characterized in the cartoon as being on a baseball diamond, Boodle to Tuttle to Black. Black, of course, is the Supreme Court Justice Hugo Black. So the case went from Boodle to Tuttle to Black and showed what decent people these federal judges could be. And so King had a good experience with the federal courts and most federal judges. And it's interesting to contemplate, although you can't know, what would he have done if the judge had denied the injunction or had kept the TRO, kept the injunction against what? Would he have marched? Would he have gone against it? I don't know. He always said he could not break an injunction issued by a federal court. He'd easily do it for a state court, but he couldn't do it for a federal court because he viewed the federal government as an ally and wanted to keep it as an ally.
Well, when we met with him on the afternoon of April the 3rd and walked up the steps, he had just gone in the room ahead of us holding the injunction that the federal marshal had given him. And there's a photograph that I don't have it here, of him sort of laughing with a guy named Cato Ellis, who was a U.S. Marshal, about getting the injunction. So, you know, you don't know what he would do. You know, there was a lot of talk about how much attention could we bring if a Memphis judge put King in jail in Memphis and there was a march. I mean, the whole thing would be much more escalated in terms of interest and whatever. I think he knew it could get worked out.
Okay, terrific. Let me ask one more question, then we'll open the floor. Towards the end of his life, he talked about the triplets of evil, racism, economic oppression, and militarism. Again, other than racism, the latter two are often not discussed. I want to ask about implications of King's views for issues today, a question that historians might find frustrating, but lawyers and law students always want to know, well, how do we apply it? What would you think would be one or more of his main concerns looking at our country today, and what do you think he would want us to do about it?
Well, I peeked at your questions while I was sitting here, so I...
When you have them in giant font.
I was thinking about this one, and I thought, you know, one big issue all over the country today is gay rights. And the state of Maryland is trying for the second time to pass a to legalize same-sex marriage, and the opposition, the story in the Post today says that the state is really split. It's difficult to do. It's hard to predict what will happen. The legislature defeated it a year ago, and they may well defeat it again. And you wonder, what would Dr. King do? Well, we have no idea what Dr. King would do. We only know one thing he ever said about gay rights. He used to write a column for Ebony Magazine, and he said, somebody wrote in and said, I feel an attraction to other men. What can I do? And Dr. King wrote, what was the thought of the day that this is a psychological problem, and if you seek some psychiatric help, it'll be cured. Well, just as you can't pray the gay away, you can't think it away either. So he was wrong, and the organized opinion in the psychiatric community was wrong then too, and they've changed their minds. And we have no idea whether he did change his mind or not. We know his wife, his widow, and his wife became a champion of gay rights, and went around the country speaking at gay rights rallies and spoke passionately about this. We also know that his daughter, Bernice, led a anti-gay rights march through downtown Atlanta with the pastor, a homophobic pastor of a big country church, big church in Atlanta. So here's the husband whose views we do not know, or we can only impute from what he said early in the 1960s. We have the widow and the wife who are taking the right position. We have the daughter who's regressing and taking the bad position, so we don't know.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think you, what I keep coming up with so often when I'm talking about things that happened a long time ago and trying to guess how would you have done something back then or when, I think one of the difficulties for Dr. King would have been is the so much of the strength of his support and his background was the African American religious community, and I think during his life, certainly the pastors of most of those churches that were very, very supportive of the civil rights movement would not have been at all supportive of his going into championing those areas. And that could be even be the case today.
Well, you know, but it was not an issue in his period, in his lifetime. It was not an issue the way it is now. And I wondered if it had emerged as an issue then, what might he have done? You can't know, of course. What might he have done if he had been seen this issue on the horizon? And this issue, you know, this is a manufactured issue that the Republican white wing in the United States has created to make rifts between African Americans and the Democratic Party. You can trace the beginning of it to, what's his name? What's the real tubby guy? Republican? Rush Limbaugh, that's it, Rush Limbaugh. And the other guy, the other guy who is the political mind behind...
Karl Rove?
Karl Rove, the other tubby guy, yeah. Karl Rove. This is a Karl Rove introduction, this issue. It's nothing that's trying, out of the black community to say, boy, what's happening with the gay people now? Maybe we ought to say something. This is an issue created by Karl Rove, and if Dr. King had been alive, and in these ifs you can't say, and historians are not supposed to have ifs, the South had won the Civil War, several books written about this. Anyway, I don't think we can know.